Yeah. So I never thought anybody'd listen to 23 podcasts anyway. So
it's the 24th one comes out Monday.
Yeah, 24 is a lot. I thought that four was. I didn't think that we could get people to listen to four of them. So, you know, I thought if we get through four, that's golden. That's like a whole month.
If we can get like 100 people to listen to four of them, wow. Yeah,
so would anyone listen to 23? Yes, so far 23. So
32,000.
Yeah, so now it's almost two dozen with this one.
Hello and welcome to the Contracting Officer Podcast. You're listening to the podcast for people who want to learn about the government market from the contracting officer's perspective. If you are a contracting officer, we hope to give you a little more insight into industry's perspective. Our mission is to make government contracting better, one contract at a time. In today's episode, we try to explain how much it can cost to write a proposal for a government RFP. Let's get started. Hey, Kevin, today we're going to talk about proposals. What does it really cost to write a proposal?
We are, and this is a big one because people have asked, number one, and number two, this is the stuff that as a contracting officer, I just didn't see it, and yep. Now I do. So
yep, me neither. I thought I knew what I was doing. So today, as usual, we're going to talk about which acquisition time zone we're in, why it's important to understand how much it costs to write proposals, why government should care about that, and why industry should care about that. And I think industry really cares about that. So before we get going, let's baseline. What is a proposal, Kevin? What are we calling a proposal here?
So I'm going to give you the Wavetop version. And essentially what we're talking about here is FAR Part 15. So contracts by negotiation, and then also including FAR Part 12, which would be commercial acquisitions that use some of the same concepts. But that's the part we're talking about as far as what is a proposal. We're not talking about a quote. We're not talking about something that it's a commoditized service or item that the government just needs you to send in an SF-1449 with a number on it. This is when you're actually having to write pen to paper and write a specific answer to a requirement.
Right. So you get a response to an RFP. There's a section L, M, or otherwise there's some instructions to offers that tell you here's what you have to submit to us in order to be considered for this award.
Think of this is a thinking document. The section L and M that's written is going to be thinking document from the government side. So this proposal is in response to that. So, and I hate to
and
say,
and both sides have to think about it. Both sides have to think about it. It's not just writing the proposal requires thinking. The government has to think about what they're asking for, what information they specifically need from the offers in order to evaluate and select the best. You know, pick a winner.
Yes, and this can even include on GSA orders. You could end up with an individual task order or a task order proposal or in an IDIQ contract. Indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity is IDIQ. But the basic idea is that you may have a multiple award IDIQ contract, which means that multiple companies won and now they're competing. Well, each competition, that's a task order proposal. So
right.
This would apply there too, is it's a thinking document. You're trying to say, hey, government, pick me.
Yep.
And here are all my reasons why. So as an example of what I mean by that, the things I didn't see as a government employee, one of the early proposals that I had as a contract specialist, actually, was with Air Force Research Laboratory. And it was, I don't know, probably like a 100-page proposal. And I remember thinking, oh, this thing's really well organized, and the tabs all attached to the pricing volume attached to the tabs, or not attached, but correlated to the tabs in the technical volume, explaining what they were doing so that I could flip back and forth and see, oh, here, look, there's a subcontract section. Well, the subcontractor didn't want to share their cost data with the prime, and the prime was a small business. So it was a separate proposal, had all the pricing data in it from the actual subcontractor. All this stuff is happening, and I'm looking at this going, oh, this is normal, right? I didn't realize that that's a complex proposal. It had multiple layers to it. There's a lot of moving parts, and it's a lot of time that goes into it, and a lot of, they call that production, but making sure all the tabs are in the right place, that kind of stuff. So that's one of the reasons that when I, as a contract specialist back in the day, reading through this, realizing that, and I've gotten thousands of proposals like that since that one, but the very first one, I was clueless as far as how much effort went into it. So that's kind of the purpose of today. This is why it's a big deal for me, is I want contract specialists, contracting officers, and then for that matter, for industry to realize don't expect them to just know that this takes a lot of work, because how would they figure it out? So that's why I want to talk about it.
So we always like to link these casts to the specific acquisition time zone. So you'd think this is a no-brainer. We're talking about proposals, so it's in zone three. It's in the RFP zone. But remember, we've talked about these proposal things. Proposal writing starts long before the RFP is released, before the draft RFP is released. This goes back to the market research zone. So the cost of a proposal is starts way before the proposal writing starts. So in the industry side, there's bid and proposal charge codes. So you're collecting costs against a specific objective, and those codes are opened up. People start applying costs to specific proposal pursuits or opportunity pursuits long before the actual RFP is released. So it's a dual zone, zone two, zone three.
And to give a feel of what that looks like, when, as a contracting officer, when you put out an RFI, I don't know, 2 days, 2 months, 2 weeks before the RFP drops, until the RFP drops, you're not in the RFP zone, right? But when that draft RFI comes out, and then particularly when the draft RFP comes out, the writing's already started. And that's why it's so important that the investment in brain power, in resources, in time, and of course, in labor and hours and money to create the proposal has already started. So that's why it's so important to do an effective RFI to get them writing in the right direction so that it's smoother later.
So while we're talking important, why is it important for both sides to understand how much proposal writing costs?
And so it's how a buyer and seller communicate. We've talked about this a lot, this whole idea of the competitive process comes down to the buyer and seller having a level playing field through the proposal. Hence the reason we've broken a lot of these acquisition time zones and whatnot into these pieces, so that you know what the buyer and seller are communicating through the proposal. So why is this a big deal? Because ambiguity in here is going to lead to mediocrity. It's one of my favorite sayings. Ambiguity leads to mediocrity. If it's ambiguous what we're trying to accomplish in section L&M in the proposal, you're going to get mediocre results. And everybody knows that, right? But a lot of times it's either forgotten or it's overcommitted, because you say, well, it can't be ambiguous, so I'm going to be all in on this proposal. I'm going to explain everything as well as I can. All of that is a huge amount of time for both sides, and it costs a lot of time and money, obviously.
So think about this in relation to your own life. The way you select a contractor, say, to put a roof on your house, roof, depends on what part of country you're from, how you say that word. So you find a contractor through any combination of marketing, past performance, networking, talking to friends or whatever. And then you may just get quotes from one or several for the price to put to do the work, and there's not going to be a whole lot of details because they all pretty much do the same thing. Think about it. If you went out to all these companies and you said, I need a 12-page proposal with double-spaced, 12 Times New Roman font on the whole thing, graphics have to be no smaller than 8 font, and you can't use anything but the primary colors. And if you ask companies to do that, you wouldn't get a single bid because nobody's going to put in that time and energy. So the government market's a little different. If you want to get in at all, you have to put in that time and energy. But the amount of proposal documentation that you have to submit could drive decision-making on whether or not a company actually bids on your acquisition if you're the contracting officer. So you can impact it.
And the additional issue with that is it may actually cause companies to not bid on as many things because they're having to put more resources into each proposal, but we'll get to more of the details on that coming up.
So it's important to understand because this is the system we have, and this, we're talking about government contracting here. We're talking about using the FAR. So some inefficiency in the process is a given. That's where why there's so many regulations in the FAR. It's not why. They're not there to create the inefficiency, but they do, right? There's rules. We have to have a fair process, give everyone equal opportunity to bid on these things, unless it's a small business set aside or something like that. But those things create inefficiency in the acquisition process versus the way the commercial world works. So some inefficiency is a given. It's driven into it by the regulations. But most of the inefficiency is self-inflicted by the government as they write the RFPs, self-inflicted by contractors as they don't do a good enough job shaping the acquisition to get the unnecessary pieces, the things that you don't need to evaluate to make a decision. If industry is doing a good job shaping, they can drive those non-decision-making factors out of the RFP.
So one of my big beefs is this idea of companies don't do enough targeting. And so that creates inefficiency that is self-inflicted, because the reality is if you're writing something that isn't the best fit for, if you're having to really force that language, that should tell you something. And again, because I've gotten proposals and we've worked with clients that they want to flufferize this whole document to make it, I made that word up, but it seems to apply, so that we can cram this into, oh yeah, we can do this. Think about what you're doing. Going back to the, go listen to podcast number 16. It talks about the idea of abundance. There are more things to chase. And that drives the cost of proposals, because it actually takes a lot longer to turn something that's average into something great instead of just have something great and just say it. Like I just did there. That's kind of cool, wasn't it? Anyway, okay. So the other part of this is that we weren't taught this. We as contracting officers weren't taught this. And so let me give you an example of what that feels like. When I decided I was going to start my own business, I actually took a proposal writing class because I wanted to really understand this process from the other side. And the process, I mean, I generally understand how to write stuff. I mean, I have an English degree, if you can believe that. So that's not the issue. The issue was, what's the process for writing a proposal? And I was amazed at how complex the overall process was and how many, I'll call them redundancies, and check this, check that, build a compliance matrix, you have a storyboard process, all of these things that go into going after a proposal that I didn't have a clue of when I was a contracting officer. And of course, you could argue, well, you don't need to care about that. Well, okay, there's lots of things you don't need to care about, but you should. And this is one of them, is that I just didn't understand how complex the process was, and it was very educational for me, and that's kind of the big reason we're doing this cast today, is that it wasn't as clear.
So, and you led us right to, why should people care? Why should the government team care? Let's start with that side. The government team should care because they're driving more costs to the taxpayers with their RFPs. More complex, more factors, more things to evaluate that don't help you actually make the decision. Unless you've thought this stuff through, it takes longer for industry to respond, which means more money. And it takes you longer to evaluate it if you're on the government side. If you have to evaluate a whole lot of things that aren't actually the decision making factors. And I took classes that taught you need to get it down to the minimum essential criteria that you need to make the decision. But it's so easy to let others creep in if you're not focused on the impact of having those extra factors. You may think, it's no big deal. If it turns out not to be an actual decision-making criteria, doesn't matter. But it does matter, because it's more cost, more time for everyone involved.
And so let me give you a story of as a contracting officer. Here's one that I screwed up because I didn't know any better, right?
Right.
So we had a piece of equipment, and we were doing an industry day on this overall process. It's a large piece of equipment, and one of the sub-assemblies could be done with different pieces of equipment that go into the larger piece, if you follow all that. So in the middle of the industry day, a contractor or a potential offer stands up and says, hey, would you consider putting this bolt, this widget, in part of the as a sub-assembly in the overall system instead of this one? And I said, yeah, we could consider that. And I said, tell you what, we'll change the RFP so that you can have alternate proposals and you can just write a second proposal.
So instead of changing the criteria to allow a range of solutions, you basically said, yeah, that's a great idea. Why don't you write two proposals and we'll pick one of them, so we're guaranteed to double your costs.
And it made sense. And if you think about it, I mean, it sounds easier.
I know.
To say it that way. I didn't see it. And granted, I wasn't a newbie, but I wasn't like I was an expert yet either. But it just, and the funny thing is that I think the reaction I got from the offer, or the potential offer, or the interested party, the guy standing there, and of course, this is to an audience, and he doesn't want to like call out the contracting officer going, you crazy? But he had this like, oh, okay.
Yeah,
he's kind of his tone, right? And I was trying to figure out why that, I thought I solved this problem. I was changing
that. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Now it's going to cost me twice as much, and you dummies have to evaluate another proposal, thus stretching out the acquisition timeline even farther.
And this is what I mean by the infinite number of decisions that contracting officers have to make. And the reason I love doing this podcast is to be able to take that experience and say to a contracting officer out there now, that's one way to do it.
Right.
But a better way to say, okay, just either flip that question back on him and say, how would you suggest that in there? Or say, we'll change the evaluation criteria so that you can give your own solution to that. And then, or for that matter, just turn to the program manager and ask them how they'd like to see it. But none of those, I thought I was solving the problem because I just made a decision and kept moving, which in some cases is a good idea. But this is one of those moments I didn't realize I was throwing a rock in the pond. I was creating a ripple effect that I wasn't familiar with. And now I am.
Yep. So government, you're driving overhead costs into contractors, into their pricing, their cost structure.
And it's gonna, like you said, it's gonna take longer to evaluate because now you're getting two proposals. And if memory serves, that company actually only did submit one proposal. And it's insane that I remember that, but whatever. They only submitted one proposal.
Of course, they're not gonna submit two.
Right. So it's funny how I still didn't see that so clearly. So it's amazing the things you pick up on.
Yeah.
And I want to foot stomp the idea here is that we're saying it increased costs. And okay, it does increase costs in monetary, but it also increases its time. It's a lot of other resources. And here's the big thing. It's a cost to the taxpayer because going back to, we want to make the system better, and making the system better is reducing the amount of time. And yes, time is money, but take the dollar signs off of for a second and think about it in terms of it's slowing everything down, and it reduces mission capability because it's taking longer. You're probably going to get more paperwork than you need. It's going to take longer to evaluate. It's going to take the industry longer, et cetera, et cetera. But the other side of this is that there's this idea of, oh, well, you know, there are so many companies out there that, you know, they can afford this. It's a corrupt system, whatever. I hear that enough that it irritates me. So, and the reason this is a big deal to me is that I like to say, use the 99% rule. And the 99% rule says 99% of people out there are trustworthy, and they're just trying to do the right thing, and they're good companies. And the 1% that make the news, those are the ones that, yeah, they're going to, you don't care that they're blowing money, and you don't care that it costs them more because they're bad companies. Well, you know what? There are 500,000 companies in SAM. If even 1% of them were these companies that make the news, which would be 5,000 companies, which it isn't that many. So you'll consider that ignore the news and assume that the company that's, you're saving them time and you're getting a better product, it's the small companies out there that really just want to serve you well. And the reason this is a foot stomper for me is that as a contracting officer, I assumed all the companies out there were all Lockheed. They had capture teams and they had budget lines for this all over the place. But a lot of the company, even the mid-sized companies, they're full of good people. They're just trying to do this right. So trust those 99% and just allow them to give you a strong proposal and accept the fact that you don't want them to spend more time on it because it's going to not just cost money, obviously. It's going to cost time and you're going to get a better product. What are some – we have some random examples of, again, things we didn't know as a contracting officer. How long does this really take?
Yeah, hypothetically, how long does it take to write a page of proposal? Think about trying to condense your thoughts and organize them in a manner that responds specifically to what the RFP is asking. It is hours by the time you get done with it, right?
Yeah, you could, let's just to pick a random example. Say it's 4 hours per page. And I'm not talking about a page of edit. You got this page off of your website and just tweaked it. You're asking, going back to this, is a thinking thing. How long did it take to write that section L? And how long did it take to write section M? And then the company is writing from scratch a solution. Now, if it's a past performance page, maybe they're not spending as much time, but you know what? Maybe they are. If it's a recent past performance, then they got to write it up the first time. So it's 4 hours. And again, this is a random example. There could be ones that are two. There could be ones that are 20 hours. There's a wide gap in here. But just to put some math on it so that you really see what we're talking about here, when you say 50-page proposal, if you had 4 hours per page to write it, 3 hours to review it, because again, this isn't just like on the government side where everything's reviewed. Same thing. Even if it's a $5 million proposal, you want people looking at it. You want the owner of the company going, yeah, this is true. This is correct. And then there's the editing, like making sure that there's the whole production process of adding the graphics and making sure they all fit and making sure that it stays within 50 pages. And it's
printing at the end, putting it in binders, all that stuff.
and are making making PDFs and making sure they actually open from like every single platform you could think of. You know, all of those things. So just there, okay, 4 + 3 + 3, 10 hours per page. So a 50-page proposal, that's 500 hours of labor. And that, again, that's not linear. It's over all the people that are touching it. But so when a 50-page RFP goes out, they're putting in 500 hours. So now I go back to my targeting thing. We have 20 companies bidding on this. See how those numbers stack up and why everything takes longer? So if we can help companies target better and say, okay, only 5 companies are going to put in 500 hours each as opposed to 20 or 30. And again, my record, you've probably heard me say this before, 41 proposals is my record, one RFP. And I've heard as recent as 10, 20, 25. So this happens all the time.
Yeah.
And we're slowing things down. So the whole, going back to the purpose of this cast, is to make government contracting better one contract at a time. This is one of those moments where you can say, I realize this is going to take 10 hours, 20 hours per page, and multiply that by the number of companies. And then, oh, by the way, you got to review that, right? How long does that take? So, Well, that's for a different cast. Yep.
That's why government should care about it. Why should industry care? I shouldn't have to say should. Industry deeply cares. Why does industry care about proposal costs? So writing proposals is how they win work. Proposal costs, bid and proposal costs, B&P, is an allowable cost per the FAR. So here's our FAR reference for the day. It's 31205-18C, Charlie. Bid and proposal costs are an allowable cost, and it is an indirect cost. It's part of the cost structure. So every dollar that contractors spend on bid and proposal costs comes back to the government as a cost on their contracts. This impacts your competitive position in industry. This is industry cares because it increases the cost that they're able to bid future efforts at. These budgets, B&P budgets, they're tightly controlled by big companies, and they should be by small companies. If you're a small company, you're not paying attention to your B&P budget. You should, but the budget itself can impact your bid decision on an acquisition. If the proposal effort is too great for the potential return, or if you've already spent all your proposal budget for the year on a whole bunch of proposals that were needlessly large, you may have to pass up on an otherwise promising opportunity so that you can bid on more stuff later in the year that you need to bid on. It's a real one-for-one. You can decide, oh yeah, so we made a budget, we blew through the budget, we're going to spend some more money on this proposal than we anticipated at the beginning of the year. But that just means your costs are higher. That all comes back to the government. So industry cares about it because it makes them more competitive. If they can stick to the budget they've created or go under the budget they've created, their costs are lower. That's a good thing. That's a good thing for everyone.
And the resource limitation here, I go back to the number one, there's only so much brain power. I mean, the companies only have so much brain power to crank this stuff out, and they only have so much time that even with the number of people that they have, there's only a limited amount of time, like you're saying before, they can only fit so many in, and they only have so much capability to actually crank out proposals. So they're having to choose here, right? And this is one of the ways that they choose. And of course, there's only so much money. So you want to put the actual dollar piece on it too.
So yeah, industry can hire more help, hire more of those things. But this goes back to the fact that it all comes back to the government in the end. It's all costing the taxpayers more.
Yeah, and it's making the system slower. So for you podcast listeners, let us know what other topics you want to hear about. And you know, send us your topics at contractingofficerpodcast.com/ and click on contact and put in an idea or any topics you'd like to hear about. We have 228 currently.
They're coming in faster than we can talk about them.
Yes, and we're trying.
Despite
the
fact that we talked very fast.
Yeah, we do talk very fast. Ours is the only podcast I don't listen to in double time. It's funny. You can connect with us on LinkedIn, on Twitter, and then now on Facebook. And as you always hear me say, we're giving away this information for free. Please help people find it by writing us a review on iTunes. It will drive our podcast up higher in the reviews. And if the podcast is enough for you, awesome. If you need more help, join the Skyway Connection community. It's a community full of government contracting folks who understand this market from the contracting officer's perspective, including includes webinars, lots of other stuff, and a resource library, and an Ask a Contracting Officer forum. So if you're looking for more help, go there. And we'd love to see you there. And thank you for being a podcast listener. Have a great day.
All right, Kevin, I'll talk to you later. Okay, that's it for this week's episode. As always, if you have questions, comments, or complaints, go to contractingofficerpodcast.com, hit the contact button, and let us know what you think. Thanks for listening. I'm like 31, 25, 18. That's a locker combination, not a Farsight.
That's hilarious. All right, let me look it up real fast.